this is how it ends. Here's the last 15 minutes.
Ruined your life. Ha 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 ha. And
the spoiler, he who spoils at night.
Yeah. Well, I'm the lamest supervillain ever. People give too much credit to the Mad Hatter.
Not enough to the March Hare?
Yeah, I think he was probably a little crazy. Well, he wasn't as crazy as the Mouse. Yeah. Mouse was an alcoholic, though.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, he wasn't even crazy. He was just drunk.
Yeah.
That's what that character was all about.
Yeah, the March Hare was just a little... I think he was secretly... See, the Mad Hatter, he was like a light serial killer, and the March Hare was a heavy serial killer.
Correct. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the podcast that's going way too in-depth into the analysis of the Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah.
I think we all sort of... Isn't it weird that a movie that basically is just like a collection of nonsensical set pieces is... The centerpiece of the movie is that the birthday party or unbirthday party scene.
Yeah.
I mean, you could scoop anything out of that movie as being like...
The centerpiece.
Yeah, but that's always what everybody always goes to. Is it the song? I don't know.
People talk about plots. That one, she just kind of wanders. That's all that happens.
Yeah, it's like, not a plot-driven movie.
No, not at all.
It's not a plot-driven story. I mean, it's pretty much just like this... nonsensical acid trip. I think it kind of is a little bit of a satire of the hierarchy of London at that time, but I mean, that's if you really want to look into it.
Probably. I always just read it as a big murder allegory about how Lewis Carroll wanted to murder everyone.
That's true.
We're going to get into this, but I'm kind of curious because I have an anecdote. That's kind of where this is going, actually.
Okay.
So, do you like the Jackie Robinson movie, this 42 that's coming up?
You're asking me now to...
Well, you're now speaking to an anecdote.
Okay. About 42?
No, not about 42. About me wearing blackface as a child. I'm serious. I'm absolutely serious.
No, I 100% believe you. Continue.
So, you know, you had to do book reports or a biography book report on some famous person. I chose Jackie Robinson, and looking back at it, I didn't know how racist I was by painting my face really black. I might have even done my lips red. I'm not sure.
Why?
I think that happened, but I do remember painting my face black and giving the presentation and talking about Jackie Robinson. And when I look back on it, I'm like, oh my gosh, but I didn't really know. So,
did anybody say anything? The teachers, your mother?
No, nobody said anything.
It just went all the way through.
Yeah.
Without a hitch.
Well, that was also like the early 90s. And I'm not saying like, you know, some right that happened or anything.
Yeah.
But that's when the whole like gangster rap thing was going down. Okay. And so... there was a lot of children that, you know, white children that wanted to be black at that time.
You know, there's a difference, though, between wearing baggy Jenko jeans and listening to Mace and going into school to do a presentation in full blackface.
I only did that once. Just that one time.
I guess everybody's allowed one blackface moment.
I guess so. I suppose so. That's really where my anecdote was going. That's all I had to say.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
I wish I could have seen this happen.
It was fifth grade, so it was close.
That's even better.
Yeah.
You were like, you weren't like 5, you were like 10, 11 years old.
Yeah, well, and the other thing, too, is, I mean, I really didn't think it was racist at the time. I didn't know that it was, like, a big deal, like, to do blackface. I didn't know it was, like, you know, so.
And we should remind our listeners that we're from Southeast Idaho, which basically in 19-whatever that would have been, 1995, 1996, it's, like, the equivalent of 1970 in the rest of the world.
That's probably not that far off. yeah. Okay. It was cool. And then after that, I did a black exploitation film, Shaft.
Yeah. I mean, that was probably more exciting because you had that really steamy sex scene with Pam Grier.
Yeah, it was always that was my favorite part.
Yeah.
That was fifth grade.
Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, so later in the episode we'll be discussing 42, the Jackie Robinson biopic, as well as you will be reviewing the movie Trance,
Mr. Danny.
The Danny Boyle film, and neither of us got to see the same movies, so we'll be splitting reviews, so it'll be kind of an interesting episode for that. Yeah.
Did my blackface, did it just throw you off?
I'm way off. I'd have no idea what we're talking about anymore.
You don't know where to go from there? You're just like, we're done. You just went blackface on me. We're done.
Yeah, once you drop blackface, you really have nowhere to go after that.
And in movie news.
In movie news, I'll start with this one. You posted a couple of these last week. AMC is considering a spin-off television show about Bob Odenkirk's Saul Goodman character from Breaking Bad.
I see.
He's like the sleazy for-rent lawyer that they have to smuggle all their money through, and he has these like kind of funny ads that play in the background of the show. It's kind of one of the only comedic reliefs in the entire series.
Well, see, I actually, that character alone, like when they said, I never thought about it before, I really didn't, but when that came up, I was like, yes, I would watch, I would be more interested in watching a show about him than, for me personally, than Walt. Walt makes me depressed and want to jump out a window at times, so to watch a character like Saul do Saul stuff and be just, you know, kind of a sleazy, horrible person, I'm pretty down for that, to be honest.
Yeah, I think it would open up a really fun format for the show, too, because unlike the Breaking Bad format, which you're following one person's arc through a kind of one ongoing story, Saul could have a very episodic kind of almost anthology sort of feel where every episode he takes on another weird case or has to hide something or smuggle something, and you could bring in a lot of fun characters.
Yeah, you could do whatever. Yeah, besides that, just the character to me is very, I don't know, I always like sleazebags. There's something to said about sleazebags. So I would be so interested in that show, actually.
He's a lot of fun to watch. All right, well, what news story do you have for me?
Just checking in with Mr. Christopher Nolan's Interstellar. They just announced last week that Matthew McConaughey, well, they're bringing in a female lead character, that's going to be Anne Hathaway. And the first thing I thought was like, holy cow, those two interacting would be, I think they'd have really cool and really good charisma, actually. So I'm pretty excited. And also to see them both in a big sci-fi kind of, I'm guessing, I don't know where he's going. It kind of sounds like 2001-ish kind of area. Maybe not. I don't know. But their chemistry alone, but I'm almost like, I'm like, man, is he making a romantic comedy, or is he going to be making a big sci-fi film? I'm really confused now.
Yeah, it's not, you know, the interesting Killer Joe, Magic Mike, McConaughey he's tapping into. He wants that Fool's Gold, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days kind of Matthew McConaughey, and he doesn't want the cool, interesting, dark Anne Hathaway like he was able to get out of her with The Dark Knight or like Rachel getting married. He really wants the Bride Wars out.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm sure that's what he's going for.
It's gonna be how to lose your extraterrestrial in 10 clicks out in space.
I like that, yeah. Okay, now that we didn't make that news, we just made it a big joke.
You also posted a trailer for Elysium, which isn't really news, but I did kind of want to bring this up. What is with all of these end-of-the-world sci-fis?
I don't know, but I don't care. I'm so excited. I watched it, and I was just like, man, I'm, like, this is one of those movies where it's not like, I mean, I can't hide my nerd. It just, like, overfloweth.
Yeah, your nerd is just all over the place.
It was beautiful. It's just beautiful. And there's suits, and they're jumping at each other and shooting guns, and there's on other planets, and, oh, man. Yeah, that's where I'm at with that one. Well, I was just so excited. And, I mean, it's by the guy that, I mean, it's by Neil Blomkamp, who did District 9, so it's going to be smart, too, and if they do a smart sci-fi film every year, like, I would just be very, very, I'd be pleased as punch.
Pleased as punch. I do think it looks the best out of the three that look like they're essentially the same movie. Elysium, Oblivion, and After Earth. I think it looks the best, and I think I like the cast in it the most, and also it definitely looks more politically taught, like it kind of has an Occupy sort of vibe going on with it. Also, he totally stole my idea.
Oh, well, yeah, of course.
Yeah. I was, for my senior year of high school, me and Keith had to do a comic book for our senior art project, which neither of us finished.
Nobody did.
No. I think maybe you were doing something like that, too. And we, the one that I did was kind of like this kind of like, I don't know, junk punky kind of anime-ish type thing, because that's what I was into back then. But basically the idea was like, Earth had become a penal colony for prisoners and the poor, and all of the rich people and all of the upper class elite and the politicians lived in a space station off of Earth because Earth had become so polluted. And so my main character was supposed to leave with his parents as a kid, but he got left behind and was like had to learn to protect himself in like a giant Earthbound slum. And this looks similar, so I'm calling a lawsuit.
There you go. Yeah, you should sue the crap out of them. Also thinking about it, too, Pacific Rim, that's kind of a big...
big sci-fi. But that looks like it's definitely more on the monster movie...
Fantasy.
Yeah, kind of. Fantasy action movie kind of vibe. Like, it's definitely... It has a sci-fi framework, but it's pretty much there to see big things hitting other big things.
Yeah, well, Del Toro also, he said color-wise, he's color-wise and kind of almost feel, he wanted to kind of go for a like heavy metal from the like Richard Corbin days, so.
I can get that. It definitely has like a big budget B-movie kind of vibe from the trailer, which I'm excited for, especially coming from Del Toro. Now, if it was Michael Bay's project, or if he was at helm, I would be a little bit more cynical.
Oh, well, of course. But then there's also the Snowpiercer. Have you seen that?
The Snowpiercer?
Yeah, that's another movie that's going to be. I think it's coming out this year.
No.
It's like a something bad happened when they're trying to fix global warming, from what I understand. And they're on a train, and the lower class live on the back side of the train, and the upper class live on the front part of the train, and shit happens.
Yeah.
And in post-apocalyptic world stuff. Yeah. So that's another one. And then there's
that.
We've got, and then on top of that, we also have the the Seth Rogen who plays himself in Apocalypse movie.
Sure, that's more... That actually feels like it should have come out last year when there was all those end-of-the-world comedies, like, what was that one with Steve Carell?
I don't know.
Making a Friend for the End of the World or something like that.
And then there was also The World's End, but that's about a pub's crawl, and that's Edgar Wright, so that's probably going to be...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, those are both coming out around the same time. And actually, I think, I don't know, I just barely saw the trailer for the Seth Rogen, James Franco one, where they're playing themselves.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it could be funny. I still root for Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, even though in reality, I really only like one of their movies.
See, I was kind of surprised by the trailer. I was like, wow, that's kind of interesting. It looked funny anyways. I'm just afraid because... Every time I've said that about a movie, they just put all their good stuff in the commercial, and then the rest of the movie really, really sucked, so...
Yeah, yeah. Going on about trailers, because I guess that's what this segment has become.
We've not done this before. It's very strange.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I like to talk about trailers, but we almost never get the time, but I'm feeling like we're going to be okay this time. The new Nicholas Winding Refn movie trailer, Only God Forgives...
Yeah, I'm there. It looks crazy and violent, and stuff's going to happen.
I juiced my pants.
Well,
it looks awesome.
I'm
don't even have, like, a critical bone in my body. I'm just, like, fanboying out over this trailer.
No, cinephiling out.
I mean, like, total geeky, 14-year-old, pimply, I already have the lunch pail.
Oh, okay. Well, that'd be a strange lunch pail.
I mean, like, it definitely looks like, visually, there's, like, this kind of, like, David Lynch-y kind of thing going on, like, there's, like, the red and blue lighting and, like, the lounge singer and all that. And then, but there's, like, this, like, Kill Bill... crazy weird samurai thing going on with maybe like a Yakuza type thing, like Ichi the Killer. I'm there.
No, it looks great. No, I agree. There's something else that kind of popped up recently that I was like, oh, yeah. I can't remember, so who cares?
Okay, let me talk about that.
I'll bring it up halfway through your...
Sure. Real quickly, I kind of wanted to go over some of the winners of the MTV Movie Awards that just happened tonight before we started recording. And you asked me a pertinent question when I brought this up, which was...
Do people still watch that?
Apparently they do. Apparently it's still a thing.
I didn't know it existed.
I remember the last few years, people were really upset because pretty much Twilight always swept it because it's based on, like... viewer votes, like you vote with your phone, like you do, like, American Idol.
No. Well, I don't know why people are surprised by that.
No. But, yeah, people were calling it the MTV Twilight Awards for a few years in a row.
They got that out of their system.
But Twilight only has one major winner this time around, and that's Taylor Lautner in Breaking Dawn Part 2 for the best shirtless performance.
Oh, good.
Personally... I would have gave that to Channing Tatum for Magic Mike, but, you know, whatever. Movie of the Year, which is basically their, you know, best picture, went to The Avengers.
That's fun. Makes sense. You know, it made a lot of money,
and it's a very populous movie, but it's actually, it's a pretty good choice out of what they have here. I mean, their nominations were Django, Silver Linings Playbook, which has a lot of nominations for the MTV Movie Awards, which is weird to me. Ted, and Dark Knight Rises, and so it went to The Avengers.
Oh, well, that's not bad.
Yeah,
I have watched it since I was like 12, but
yeah, back when they used to have
music on MTV.
Yeah, like the Bowling for Soup song. Okay, well, we'll move on now to the pet topic, which I was supposed to come up with, and since I saw 42. I've been thinking a lot about biopics and popular films about actual historical figures. Of course, last year we had Lincoln.
Oh, you would.
And, you know, I mean, it's a popular form because the story's already there, and you can build, you have a built-in audience because people know who the person is significant for, unless you're doing a really weird biopic on someone nobody's ever heard of. Which, I think that should happen. We should, like, you should do a biopic, like a really big budget, like $50 million biopic on your next-door neighbor.
Okay.
But I just kind of wanted to discuss the form. What are your favorite biopics? What do you think is problematic about the form? Is it a genre you get particularly excited about?
Well, let's. I mean, I have to kind of think about it. It's not a. It isn't necessarily a genre that I'd necessarily get excited about. The ones right off the top of my head, and is like the Johnny Cash one, Walk the Line, that came out a few years ago. I was kind of a big, I liked that one quite a bit.
You were so excited about that too.
I was.
We all had to dress up and like, and I don't think we dressed up, but I think maybe you suggested that at one point.
Yeah. Did I really? Because I don't think so.
That's, I don't know. I remember there was going to be a black cake.
Oh yeah. No, that did happen. I was really excited. You're right.
I didn't even
remember being that excited. But you are correct.
Yeah. I like that movie.
I like it. I like. Okay. No, I like biops more when it's like it kind of plays on a character. It isn't necessarily exactly that person's life.
Sure.
So
a weird one that kind of follows along those lines. Was the Bob Dylan biopic? Yeah, I'm Not There. Where they got like five or six different actors to play Bob Dylan, including Kate Blanchett, who was either nominated or won an Academy Award for her portrayal as Bob Dylan. And it's a Todd Haynes film, so it's really weird and experimental and kind of changes not only the actors every time they pick a different part of his life, but they also change the way they film it. Some of it's better than other parts, but it's interesting to watch, if not for more for the cinematic bizarreness of it.
Sure.
Which is what I can say about almost any Todd Haynes movie.
I really can't think of any off the top of my head.
Well, I think we both were surprisingly fair to Lincoln.
Yeah. Well, that one, because it looked like the driest. Originally, part of your question was, what do you think? And part of my problem, some of the problems with those films, is usually they end up kind of dry and kind of boring. Or they just kind of, I don't know, they don't want to. It's usually of somebody pretty popular, and so they don't really want to come, like, with a bad light. Or they try to focus on their whole life, and you just get this, like, random blurb of stuff that's happening.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really, there's not a cohesion.
Or the arc is just so by the numbers. Like it seems like the form of the biopic is so kind of set in stone now. You know, you have, like, a scene in the beginning of the movie where they're a kid and they have that moment where they realize they're going to be whatever they're going to be. And then they have a couple years before they really become the person we know them to become, and like their formative years or whatever. And then they become the thing that we know that they're going to become. They have a series of what Mark Kermode has called the chubby moment, which is a really oblique reference to the Karen Carpenter biopic.
Oh,
but basically,
okay.
Basically, the theory goes that in the movie Superstar, about Karen Carpenter, which is a TV movie back in, like, I think the late 70s, early 80s, there's this moment where, you know, she's reading a review for one of their first concerts or something like that, and the person in the paper describes her as slightly chubby or something like that, and she goes, "Chubby? Hmm." And so you have that moment, I think, that that pops up in a lot of those biopics, where the person, like, winks at the screen and says, "This is the thing I'm famous for."
You're right.
And actually, I think a really good biopic that I think it really experiments with that form and has a surprising lack of chubby moments is The Social Network, which you never really even think about as being a biopic because it is so different and good and not particularly favorable to the subject.
Well, also, I think it kind of, to be honest, too, he doesn't, like, try to stay necessarily so true to the person's life. Like, I'm sure that some of the things didn't happen exact, and so that's what I'm saying. Like, films like that are usually more interesting, where it's about a thing as opposed to
just a reverent idol set up for the person they're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. There's a lot of president ones. That sort of seems to be what America likes to do, is we love presidential biopics.
Well, there's also a lot of serial killer ones, but yeah. they're usually direct-to-DVD.
And those ones are probably more entertaining than the president ones, to be fair.
Agreed.
I think I'd probably rather watch the Dahmer one with Jeremy Renner than, like, you know, Oliver Stone's Nixon.
Fair enough.
Did you ever see W?
I did. I actually kind of liked that one.
Yeah.
His take on it was, I mean, because it was modern and stuff like that, and it was happening at the, I mean, he was, George W. was the president at the time, so it was pretty, a little different. He kind of took it head on.
Yeah, and I heard that it was both kind of a warts and all type of thing, but it was also fair as well.
It was slightly, yeah, he wasn't directly like, oh, he's a stupid jackass and that's all he is. Like, he was very fair, I thought, and he was very, but he also said he had his own take and said what he was going to say. But again, that he took more, he went more with the theme rather than being, I think, completely true.
Even though the history was so fresh and recent. I don't know. It's one that I'm a big fan of. Even though it is like very much blueprint biopic kind of material, is the Harvey Milk movie Milk.
Okay.
Which I had never seen the documentary, The Life and Times of Harvey Milk, before I saw the movie, and I'm glad I didn't, because when I saw the documentary, I was really like, oh, wow, they just kind of beat per beat made a movie of this documentary. Oh. And both are actually really good. I think they're actually good companion pieces. But I think that was directed by Gus Van Sant.
Yeah.
And it was, I mean, you know, there's a lot of different versions of Gus Van Sant out there as a filmmaker. Like, there's Gus Van Sant, the commercial director, not commercial as in TV commercial, but, like, you know, who makes more kind of populist movies like Good Will Hunting and Finding Forrester or Promised Land. And then there's Gus Van Sant, the weird, experimental, Euro-ish kind of auteur, and he does movies like Elephant and Jerry and Paranoid Park. And then there's the Gus Van Sant who is kind of does these kind of political polemics. And I actually thought that Milk was a good one. And it also, I think it's one of, I think more than anything, I like the performances in the movie. And I really liked Sean Penn in the role because he really disappears in it. And he doesn't have those kind of Sean Penn-isms that bug me. And he plays a likable guy. I think Sean Penn always just kind of comes off as, like, unapproachably grumpy in most movies. But he in Milk, he's such a nice, like, funny character that you could, like, okay, this Sean Penn I could see, like, having lunch with.
Sure.
He's
a bit more personable.
Yeah. And James Franco, that was one of the first things I ever saw him in where I was like, oh, wow, this kid actually can act.
Yeah. Raging Bull is one that's pretty good. That's about a real person, but you always kind of forget about it.
Yeah, I think that's because it's such a director's showcase
Yeah.
And that you don't, yeah, you don't really connect it to its origins as a true life person, but it was based on a book, that, De Niro actually convinced Martin Scorsese to adapt. It took him something like from the time he did Mean Streets all the way to when they started filming it to convince him to do it because, Scorsese wasn't sure if he could do boxing. But yeah, I mean, come on, it's Raging Bull.
Yeah, I mean, but I mean, that's sometimes you kind of forget about some of them.
Well, I think we're getting down to something here, which is a biopic tends to be better when it's not so respectful and trying to turn the person into a messiah figure or something like that. I mean, you don't want to, like, just cynically make them look bad for no reason, but, you know, I think they're more interesting when they're about something besides the life and importance of the character.
Well, you don't want to get too bogged down in the, you don't want to get too bogged down literally in the history, because if you get too, like, well, this didn't happen on this date, then it's like, okay, that's not really what we're looking at, you know?
Yeah.
What's the idea? What's it getting at, so...
I mean, I think the thing that made Lincoln so exciting for us was the fact that it was more of an ensemble movie, really.
Well, he didn't, you know, do like, oh, his childhood and blah, 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 this. He didn't, you know, it was more about the political process than it was.
About Lincoln, per se. Yeah, which is, I thought it was actually kind of funny that he won best actor for that movie because he was good in it, but he was really only a service to something a lot bigger than him.
Yeah.
In that movie. So I'll go on from there and just go into my review of 42, the Jackie Robinson movie. And though you can't see me, Richard, I actually did powder up in blackface to do this review.
Oh, well, thank you. It makes me feel better.
You're welcome. You weird, weird person. Okay, so 42 is the story of Jackie Robinson, who was the first African-American baseball player in the 40s, who was discovered...
By Harrison Ford, right?
Yeah, but I didn't want to say it like that.
Yeah, I did it for you.
Yeah. He was discovered by a man named Branch Rickey, who owned the Dodgers, and he decided... Kind of, I mean, the movie doesn't really describe why he decided, but he decided to basically hire Jackie Robinson as a political statement about segregation in America. And he knew going into it that he was going to have a hard time and he was going to be, against a lot of adversity. As soon as he brings him on, he's going to have to be defending himself constantly. And he asked Jackie, played by Chadwick Boseman, that if you're going to, you know, if you want to do this, if you want to be a professional ball player, you're going to have to suppress your urge to basically kick everyone's ass. you got to be the bigger man. You got to be the gentleman and, you know, never flinch and turn the other cheek. There's a lot of strong religious messaging in this movie. And there's a lot of strong messaging in general. And I think... I think the movie's fine. I think it's biopic 101. It's written and directed by Brian Hedlund, who has also done films like Mystic River. He was the writer for Mystic River and Green Zone. And he has directed films such as The Order and A Knight's Tale. So he's kind of a workman director, and that's sort of what he brings here. It's this kind of, you know, kind of come in, get it done, and get out kind of thing. He's like, you know, you want your Jackie Robinson movie? Here it is. And there's a lot about this movie that I think is easy to be cynical about. I think... It's very, very sentimental. It's very, very on the nose. The entire movie pretty much exists on the tip of its nose. The entire movie is basically a Chubby Him moment. Every scene is an Oscar clip. You know, like every actor is trying to be important and you know, thematic, and every line of dialogue, you know, has like swelling Spielbergian music coming up behind it, and it's lit very pretty. The whole thing looks kind of like a postcard. Actually, the production design was not too far off of what Gangsterland looked like. So you know pretty early on that this is a romanticized melodrama take on this kind of figure. And what's funny about it is everything about it is over the top and melodramatic and heavy on the message and really pounding everything very unsubtly. But the main performance of Jackie Robinson as a character, which is the main character, by Chadwick Boseman, he's underplaying everything. He's really the only naturalistic thing in this movie. He's a man of few words. He doesn't say a lot, but he means what he says when he says it. And he actually, I think he took this a little more or less seriously than everybody else. You have a lot of fun character actors that pop up in here. Nobody's playing anything with a lot of depth. I think everybody is really kind of playing an archetype or a stereotype. But the cast is actually pretty solid. I mean, you have Harrison Ford, who's just doing the Harrison Ford grumble, grumble, growl, growl thing that he does, but it's used to somewhat a good effect. But you have, like, Chris Maloney early on, who plays one of the coaches, who he gets to have a lot of fun until he kind of drops out of the picture. But then you have, like, little actors like Alan Tudyk, who plays this really ridiculous racist who's just singing the N-word.
Oh, well, that was fun for him.
I had fun watching it. I couldn't take any of the scenes seriously because it's Alan Tudyk, but I was quite enjoying him just, you know, being hardcore racist. And then you have really interesting, like, up-and-coming actors like Lucas Black and Hamish Linklater, who play some of the other ball players on this team. So even though the whole thing is so ridiculously obvious and kind of pandering to the lowest common denominator, I kind of did get swept up in it, in its big, cheesy TV movie of the week sort of way.
See, some of them can be like that. Like, I didn't think that necessarily Johnny Cash one was this, like, the best ever. But at the same time, I really did kind of, like, just kind of get into it. The music helped a lot, though, too.
Yeah, I mean, you have that going for that. But also, I think there is something about that biopic form that it's a successful form for a reason. It's a formula, but it sometimes it works. And sometimes you just kind of, once you know exactly what you're settled into and you drop your expectations of what it could be, as I did this movie pretty early on, you just kind of allow yourself to enjoy that form. It's like, okay, this is macaroni and cheese. I like macaroni and cheese.
Sure. No, that makes sense.
Extra emphasis on the cheese.
Okay. The movie I saw was by Mr. Danny Boyle, a recording director of such things as 127 Hours, 28 Days Later, The Beach, Sunshine. You know, he maybe won an Oscar or two. Mm-hmm. You know, not a big deal. little-known director, really.
Yeah.
But he just came out with his movie this year starring James McAvoy, Vincent Cassell, and Rosario Dawson was the big three power players in it. But, I mean, the movie, I won't go too much into the plot just because, first of all, it'd be really difficult. second of all, it's not really, it's kind of a mystery movie, so you probably wouldn't be too happy if I did. So, I mean, the film itself is just about this, basically this guy after a heist, they're trying to find a painting that he stashed, and they get a hypnotherapist that's played by Rosario Dawson to kind of help that along. And you really get into some classic, this really kind of plays up on some of the classic, like, Shallow Grave kind of Danny Boyle.
Yeah. Well, this was written or co-written by John Hodge, which
right.
Was one of Danny Boyle's early writers who wrote some of his first kind of heisty movies like Shallow Grave and Trainspotting and A Life Less Ordinary.
Sure. It does have some very similar takes to it. What the film does beautifully and wonderfully is the cinematography and the color scheme of this movie just blew me away. And the music mixing into it did as well. It almost put me in a trance. I know how cheesy that is, but it really did. The mixture of things really just kind of, it puts you in the place. And the other thing it does is this movie, I haven't squinched at a movie for probably a while. And I mean, Evil Dead, I took that like a champ. This movie, I hid behind my fingers at times.
Oh, wow.
There are some, I mean, he really brings the intensity in scenes in this movie. And so, this is a movie where I really, really enjoyed the ride. And I'm going to give you a warning if you don't want to hear this, Cassidy. But at the end, the ending seemed almost too happy and patched in. It didn't really seem to match the rest of the momentum of the movie. And so I don't know if it's just this kind of film has a tendency to do that or what, but there seemed to be something that just didn't feel right about the end of this film to me.
Hmm.
And it seemed almost a little too cheesecake, a little too happy, especially mixing in a lot of the other elements from the movie. And the twists and stuff like that, the ride is the best part of this film, and it's a hell of a ride. And so I do recommend it to people.
Where would it stack up against other Danny Boyle movies for you? Is it pretty similar to those other John Hodge things, or...?
It's similar. I mean, it's almost... he goes a lot more, almost kind of like, there's almost, because in those films there were like quieter moments, this almost, he kind of like, it reminded me almost a little bit of something like like Refn in Drive, where he really used the music to kind of put this tone and this pace and kind of get you hooked in. And, he also used the visuals in it were so striking. There were scenes that I was just like, wow, I cannot, how did he like architect this? I mean, he must be a genius and he has got a good budget, sure, all that. But the way that the editing in the first 90% of this film goes really, really pays off.
Cool.
Stacking up-wise, I have a hard time, actually, because it kind of does its own thing at the same time, but...
A little more distance from it before you could...
Probably. Shallow Grave itself is probably a tighter film, because I really feel like the ending, Trainspotting, is also a tight film. It kind of has a rock star... This one kind of has a rock star vibe, too. Maybe a lot sneaker of a rock star vibe. Definitely not as raw and rough. But the other things too is like I'm always surprised. Danny Boyle often uses like the protagonist overlay voice over images, but it works in his films.
Yeah,
just works. It worked in this one. Didn't annoy me at all. By and by, it's a great film. I don't know if it's his. It's one of visually. It's just breathtaking, but like I said, I had a hard time with the ending. He just built it up so much, and it was there was parts that were so rough and so intense that I actually had a kind of a hard time coming back down to that warm and fuzzy at the end. And so, also performance-wise, James McAvoy, I mean, they all brought it. I would say that his is probably actually... James McAvoy is probably the weakest, but that's not really saying anything up against in this actual ensemble and in this movie. It may be the switching, going from the aggressive to the aggressor to the victim. Maybe that kind of plays with your perception. But this is a film that did kind of, I don't know, I was in a trance when I watched it.
Cool. So, do they play a lot of trance music?
Yeah, kind of. No, the music really is part of that. It is a real part that really draws you in and kind of strings you along. They do some lovely, like, because they also do this in and out, and they literally go into the brain, into the thoughts, and into the mind.
Yeah, I heard it has kind of like a
existential moments.
Yeah, I heard it has kind of like an Eternal Sunshine, Inception-ish type plot devices.
Sort of, yes.
Yeah, I'm excited to see this movie. I mean, I'm a huge Danny Boyle fan, and I always kind of like when he's being a little bit more naughty than nice. Like, I as much as I like Slumdog Millionaire, I think that's far and away one of my less favorite Danny Boyle movies, even though that's the one he won the Oscar for. And I'm interested to see him re-teaming with John Hodge and kind of making something a little bit more experimental and sort of fun and spicy. So, cool.
Basically, all in all, yeah, my review was great film, but a little weak on the landing, I guess.
All right. Well, I think I read somewhere that To the Wonder, Trance, and Place Beyond the Pines might be going VOD.
Oh.
So if they do that, I might be able to see those movies and
we can pick up a discussion from there.
All right. Well, we'll move on to our last segment, which is another film that's going to be a little difficult to talk about. And that's our Netflix homework, which is Holy Motors, which was a French-released movie that came out last year that I saw a lot of people kind of talking up and talking about, and I think this made a lot of people's top 10 lists and that kind of stuff. And it's directed by a man named Leos Carax. And it's a very strange, kind of surreal, experimental movie about a man, kind of actually not too far off from Cosmopolis, who, in a limousine for a lot of the movie. And he has all of these quote-unquote assignments that he has to do, or arrangements that he has to do in his city. And he travels from sort of one end of town to the other, and he makes these stops in completely different makeup, in completely different characters, and he sort of enacts these kind of cinematic set pieces that we sort of see in certain types of genre movies. But he's kind of like a like flash mobbing cinema, if you will. And then he kind of takes off and leaves and goes to the next one. And the movie really kind of blurs that line between what's real, what isn't, what is metaphor and what is supposed to be read literally. And it's almost kind of like takes a similar approach that Cloud Atlas took in genre hopping like that, but rather than doing it in totally different unrelated stories, it's done with one fluid character kind of moving through a point A to point B in the plot. But yeah, I don't know. What did you think of Holy Motors?
Are you still processing?
Well, I mean, this is a movie that you could process for the rest of your life if you like to. It's highly ambiguous, but I'm interested to hear what your take was.
You know, first of all, this is one of those films that I really, I mean, it really calls back to like the 60s European art house kind of films. Sure. It really does.
I was strongly reminded of 8½ and Persona when I was watching it.
Yeah, exactly. That was the one I was going to bring up, is Persona. That the first little lead-in kind of, like, act, movie, whatever, scene thing you want to call, really reminds me of that first part of Persona, where the director almost kind of looks at you and goes, I'm making a movie about stuff.
You are watching a movie, in case you didn't know.
And yeah, watching a movie by me. This film, I mean, it definitely does. It meanders and it wanders. And I did like that you said Cosmopolis, because that was one of the first things I thought as well. It could have just been the limousine, but yeah.
I mean, we break out of the limousine a lot more than that movie, but but the limousine does kind of play almost a character in the same way that Cosmopolis did.
You could say it does.
quite literally.
It literally becomes a character in this sense. As a reviewer, basically what I would tell people, if you are interested in the kind of European art house kind of sensibility, and you're willing to go on a very crazy existential, surrealist, crazy-ass ride, fucking go for it. but if that's not your bag, this is going to be a film that just throws you a loop and you will not like it.
Yeah, I think this is a love-hate movie.
You have to be willing to go for it. And I liked it. I liked it. I mean, I was a lot more, maybe it's because of my, it kind of makes me have to kind of almost analyze myself as a film goer. I am more of a popularist, and I love me some genre. And so that first act where I really like the artificial nature, the interesting artificial nature of him, and how beautiful it was to do like his green screen mocap work.
Yeah. What was really interesting about that mocap scene, because yeah, there's a scene where he basically goes in and does this kind of weird contortionist sex scene martial arts thing with this weird woman,
the ginormous bendable woman.
Yeah. But it was gorgeous to look at, and you had the same sense as watching something in CGI, but you were watching something naturally shot.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He was basically, I don't know, I thought that whole scene was so clever, and looked like, this is the thing we use to make something look beautiful, but isn't it more beautiful just to watch it like this?
It almost is. Well, he doesn't make a lot of comments on modern cinema.
Yeah.
The Beauty and the Beast almost kind of aspect where he goes and he abducts
Ava Mendez. yeah.
And bites people's fingers off and is this weird fucking Jesus Christ leprechaun gnome thing. that's my most apt description. I'm sorry. Yeah.
There was a lot of weird... I liked that sequence because it was so like, what's going to happen next? I really don't know. Also the hardest to interpret. Like, there was definitely a lot going in there about religion. There was a lot going in there about genre cinema, because it sort of starts out like a horror film. There's a lot going in there about the Madonna horror complex and, like, feminism or something. The whole movie is basically, like, just tossing out ideas like confetti.
This had a lot going on in it, you're right. Well, I do think that the religious, you go to religion, I don't think it was saying much about religion. I think it was more using the familiar, in La Dolce Vita, like Federico Fellini kind of uses religion as kind of like a this is how we worship our stars kind of thing. So that's how I interpreted that, at least.
Sure, sure. I mean, there's a lot about that, about like what it is to be a movie star and what it is to be paid to entertain somebody and what that makes you. I think Dennis Levant, who plays basically the majority of the characters in this movie, love or like the movie or hate it or whatever, you can't deny what a crazy, versatile, and experimental and fun actor he is.
That I agree with, yeah, definitely. One thing I was going to say about that scene, though, with the Jesus Christ leprechaun gnome thing, was that when he goes up to be very violent, he bites that lady's fingers off, that poor, poor lady.
Yeah.
I will say that scene and that buildup and everything he did in that reminded me of a Haneke movie.
Yeah, kind of. The way he takes on violence in that way.
Well,
in a way, there's something about the thematic elements of this movie is sort of similar to Funny Games. Specifically, a scene later on in the movie where he's dressed as kind of like this thuggish gangster type, and he interacts with another thuggish gangster type that he also plays. And what he's sort of saying about action movie violence in that scene, I think, is kind of clever.
No, I think most of them are clever, but I mean, you have to really be willing to go for a ride. You could almost you need to watch it all together, but you have to be ready for it. Yeah. Not ready for it. No, you don't need to be ready for it. I don't know. That's how I feel about this film.
Richard says, I don't know.
I liked it in general. It was done. It was visual. Again, this is another movie that visually just kind of like stimulated the hell out of me. And this one definitely made me a lot more reminiscent. I wasn't there and being like, whoa. This one made me reminiscent of a lot of films.
Yeah.
And kind of takes me to.
Yeah, that's also sort of the point. I mean, this movie even has a musical sequence. Kylie Minogue.
Strange kind of too.
Yeah, the whole movie is a strange experiment. But I think as far as that goes, it's one of those ones you have to have an open mind for. You have to really, it's very super cine literate, so you have to kind of be on top of your toes. And even if you are,
he's probably throwing stuff at you don't know.
Yeah, everything's open to interpretation, so you can't really nail it down. It always kind of slips away from you every time you think you have a handle on it, which if you're not into that sort of experience, you will find it to be a frustrating film. But I think if you just let your guard down and kind of go with the flow, it's definitely not boring. And I think it's really visually gorgeous to look at. And the lead performance by Dennis Levant, I think, is kind of mesmerizing.
Oh, yeah. No, he did spectacular. Were there parts that you don't have? See, for me, there are parts where I feel so definite what it's about, and then there's the parts, like, to be honest, I'm not really entirely, I don't know. It's also a film, if you like thinking about films.
Yeah.
And if you haven't got that already, guys.
Yeah.
this is a film that really makes you kind of think. And
I could see this being a film that you could revisit about every 10 years after you've seen more movies. And then you go back and you're going to interpret certain things a different way.
Sure.
So I think it is cool in that sense, but it also, there's plenty that I wasn't sure if I got. I mean, I have theories as to what a lot of things meant, but I wouldn't say that I'm confident in any of it.
No, there are parts that I felt confident, and then there are parts that I felt, and that just might be, you know, my own hubris or whatever, but brought up the Kylie Minogue part,
okay,
is because I literally just, that the whole music, I get that was supposed to be musical and I kind of understood what's happening there, but I felt like I was missing something. It definitely reminded me of French New Wave.
It has a very kind of guitar feel to it.
But at the same time, I don't know.
Yeah.
what about the persona? That's where I'm at.
Okay. I like this movie. I don't think
you'll watch with somebody who also loves film and then talk
about it. Yeah, you'll want to see it with, you'll want to be able to talk to somebody about it. And like I said, you have to have an open mind for this type of stuff. It is pretty arty. But I did enjoy it a lot, and I think that, you know, even considering it's sort of an art house film, I do think it has entertainment value.
No, agreed.
So what do you have for us next week?
Next week I think we should try. You know, we've gone a little too highbrow. I think we're losing it. maybe we should do The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai.
I didn't know it was on the queues, and I've never seen it before. I'd be interested in seeing it. It's something of a cult kind of thing that people are into. I remember Carl had a rubber bracelet that he bought specifically from, like, a fan page online.
Wow, that's pretty
specific.
Pretty specific.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know. I think we should give this a try, and
sure.
Hopefully it doesn't throw my brain for a super loop.
Yeah. I mean, I think we had so many of those, like, direct-to-Netflix, indie exploitation things in a row that we were just starving for. And then, plus, we were living in the beginning of the year where we had nothing but like, crap every week.
Yeah.
So, I think we were starving for good movies, so we've been really awfully highbrow and arty in our Netflix homework. So, yeah, let's bring it back, let's bring it down to something goofy and culty.
Yeah, maybe a little fun. Sure.
Cool. Well, that is our episode, and if you have anything you have to say about any of the movies we talked about today, Trance, 42, if you want to get in contact with us, you can get in contact with us through our email, which is jabberinthedrone@gmail.com, or if you have anything you just want to say about the show in general, any helpful comments or criticisms, anything, talk to us. You can also talk to us through our Facebook page, which is Facebook.com/JabberPodcast. Like us there, and you can see whenever we post new episodes or news items in between episodes or any announcements about delays or anything like that. You can also suggest Netflix homework that we haven't covered in past episodes. You can subscribe to us through iTunes, where popular podcasts are usually found. Go to the iTunes store, type in Jabber and the Drone. You should see us pop up, and you can subscribe there and write us a review, just keep a couple seconds about what you think about the show. And we are also available for streaming and download at our normal Podbean website, which is jabberandthedrone.podbean.com. You can also leave comments there. You could just stream it from your computer if you're just listening at work or something like that. In which case, why aren't you working? Really? Really?
Don't work.
Don't work. Just
that's something I've learned in my life.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty much all I do at work is listen to podcasts because I'm driving. You can read my movie reviews at salifworkreviews.blogspot.com. That's where I post my reviews from the Bannock Alternative and the Idaho State Journal. I just posted my Evil Dead review from last week. And I have some content available on the MacGuffinPodcast.com, a Seattle-based media webpage, and I have a couple things there to read. You can find me under the other authors, Cassidy Robinson, and Richard is, I don't know, where are you today? Do you want to be inside your own mind in some sort of crazy trance, or do you want to be having sex with a CGI snake lady?
Both, if possible.
In your mind, having sex with the CGI snake lady.
So I'm literally physically having sex with a snake lady, CGI snake lady, but in my mind I'm another place, in a trance.
All right, then. That's our show, and we will talk to you next week.
Is that all you got? Oh, wow.
You start us with blackface and then you end us with that.